Hello, and welcome to Horrible Friends Condensed Spoop, a smaller, shorter version of our normal show where we talk about new horror movies, review those horror movies, and anything related to the horror genre. I'm Chris, and today I'm joined by Mike, John, and Swayze. How's it going, boys?
I'm doing well, bud. Glad to be back.
I'm here, too.
And I'm so excited about it. So today we are going to be talking about a new series at the time of this recording. Just came out a couple days ago. It is Netflix's The Fall of the House of Usher, written and created by my favorite, Mike Flanagan.
Don't be like that. It's your favorite, yeah, Mike Flanagan.
My favorite. Yeah.
Have you guys seen this new Mike Flanagan movie? Scratch, scratch, itch, itch.
Yeah. All right, so for today, we are just going to talk about the first four episodes. There's eight episodes in total. They are all available to watch now on Netflix. This will be a spoiler-filled review, so if you haven't seen the first four episodes, I would suggest, you know, pausing this podcast, watch them, and then come back here and hear our thoughts on it. All right, so we're just going to jump in and just go with it. So this series is basically just an entire love letter to everything Edgar Allan Poe. Each episode is a title of one of his major works. And even though the series is called Fall of the House of Usher, kind of the story of Fall of the House of Usher is kind of like the background player. And then each episode is just a major highlight of one of Poe's stories. So for our first episodes, we've got A Midnight Dreary. Episode two, we've got The Mask of the Red Death. Episode three, Murder in the Rue Morgue. And then episode four, we've got The Black Cat. So who wants to give their feelings on that first episode right away?
I'll say that with that first episode, I don't think it was the best start to a series in terms of like what Mike Flanagan has done in the past. It was the first time that I was watching it and I got major American Horror Story vibes from it. It kind of seemed like it was diving into that more bougie, sexually liberal kind of thing where everybody has like a weird kink that goes with them. I mean, I know we don't kink shame here in Horrible Friends.
We don't kink shame our Horrible Friends.
but it's like everybody has like their thing. And I remember thinking this is not like that gothic, very like nuanced way of doing things in the past. Because if you watch Hill House, everybody at Hill House has something identifiable with them, like something that makes them, you know, empathetic. And you just don't like any of these characters right off the bat. And it took me a minute to really get where he was going with these characters and what he was doing with them that got me on board. I think I got on board by the end of this episode, if not the beginning of the second episode.
Oh, yeah, no, I agree. Like, and basically what you said, like each of these characters has like their vice, and they are written to make you hate them, but you love to hate them. Like, I don't think there was actually a single character like I hated, like actually like just didn't like and hated their existence in the show. Like, I hate them as characters, but I also love them like completely.
It's like that old slasher trope of making your character so unlikable that you look forward to them dying. I guess in a way this series so far is a classy slasher in that sense.
No, yeah, I agree. So yeah, like the first episode we just get a little bit of the backstory of, you know, the Usher family. And we essentially kind of Tarantino's the story a little bit, right? Because we see, you know, Roderick Usher at like the funeral for like six of his kids. And then it jumps to him telling the story of it. And sorry, I had some stuck in my throat again. But yeah, that's basically what episode one is. It's just it basically just kind of sets the tone a little bit of what the whole series is. And it's Roderick Usher. Hold on. All right, Mike, I know you probably remember how to pronounce it. So Carl Lumbly's character, is it Augustin Dupin?
I think it's Dupin.
August Dupin. I don't think he pronounces the E as an extra. I think it's just August Dupin.
Well, while you're looking at it, I wanted to add about that character specifically, Dupin, is that I was floored by his inclusion in it, because obviously he has no connection to House of Usher, but he's a very, very important character in the history of literature, because a lot of people argue he's the OG literary detective. Like his appearance in the Rue Morgue, I think it is considered the first murder mystery ever.
Yeah, that was pre Sherlock Holmes too, wasn't it?
Sherlock is the no, Dupin is the inspiration for Sherlock, supposedly.
Okay.
The more you know.
Yeah, and it was that kind of the thing. I heard the character's name, and the whole time me and Jackie were watching the first four episodes, I was just sitting in the back of my mind. I'm like, I know I've like either heard or read that name before, but I can't remember where. And like that night we went to sleep, I was just laying in bed, like immediately just started Googling it. Like, I need to know. And I was like, oh, that's right. He's from this story. And that's just more of that. Like, this is just a love letter to Edgar Allan Poe. Like, there's so many like Poe details in all of these episodes. So episode one ends with basically Roderick sitting down with Dupin and pretty much just telling him the story of what happened to each of his kids leading up to the funeral. Which, by the way, at the funeral, we see the character Verna, played by Carla Gugino, who, at least in my mind so far, like with this, like until at least to see the end of the series, I've just kind of viewed her as like the angel of death.
So in looking up the name of that character earlier, because I was having trouble trying to figure out who it was, I found out what it is. I'm not going to spoil it, but I also felt the same way that you did. The character acts like a messenger of death and is portrayed like that at the end of the first episode very well.
It's interesting you're saying angel, because upon my viewing, I took her more as like a demonic entity. I thought of her more in line with Faust and like Devil Went Down to Georgia, like that sort of devil.
Mm-hmm. No, that's fair. Because I either thought of her like the angel of death, or, you know, like the harbinger of death. You know what I mean?
No. Yeah, I can see. I think it's like, I mean, we're still like, what, halfway through this. So the revelations of what her character is going to be in the long run is still to be revealed.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Now we're just talk about these other three episodes. So, second episode, Mask of the Red Death. Why don't each of you tell me like your favorite thing about it, or your favorite part of that episode?
You mean besides the fact that Kib was trying to set up like the world's biggest orgy party?
Yeah. Besides that, and also, you know, fuck his brother's wife.
You know, my man has seen probably way too much corn videos, and was just like, I see a goal in sight. I can do one of my fantasies.
Mm-hmm.
I think that character was when I realized, oh, I'm supposed to hate everybody here. Because he just comes off the bat like being a complete douchebag at that board meeting. And he just is like a sower of chaos. Like, he's resentful for being essentially the bastard of the family. And it seems like everybody hates each other, but I know like the one brother who was the dad in Hill House particularly dislikes him.
Yeah. And he's like, I think there was like three of the kids are like bastard childs, but they basically treat, they call him like Perry. Like, he is like the bastard.
Yeah. He's like the unwanted child.
Before you even like meet him, like they all just keep saying like, cause there's, you know, there's like a background information, like there's some kind of like informant from inside the family trying to like, you know, release dirt on them, and, you know, and it's not good, and they're trying to figure out, and it shows like almost every single one of like the family members saying it's probably him. So at first, like hearing all that, I'm like, oh man, feel bad for this kid. Like, they're all just saying like he's the one probably ratting them all out. And then as soon as we actually meet him, I'm like, oh no, he's a piece of shit.
Right, like the first time we meet him is when he's pitching his idea for like a global bar that, as he puts it, the real MVPs can get head from celebrities. in the back. So he just wants a bar that is constantly having an orgy that is in every country. That's what he wants. So like immediately I was just like, I hate this kid. Also, he dresses like a douche.
To how he describes it, like, oh, you want the money to, what was it, they make like a blowy whiskey bar? Yeah, no thanks.
And this whole character and this whole episode was when I started to think we were really creeping into that American Horror Story territory, because like the people he hangs out with and the characters in this episode like just scream of that like ilk. And I was wondering if this is going to be something we get deeper into, if this is just a one-off for this character. It kind of concerned me, because I thought like the subtlety in Flanagan is what makes him great. So when you have like these more like exploitative elements, I was concerned it was going to drag down the content, the value of the show.
The only thing Perry is screaming is that he has mommy and daddy issues.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, sister-in-law issues, maybe?
That's just a personal vendetta because the brother's so mean to him.
Oh, yeah. Just like, he's just like, you're going to be mean to me? Well, I'm going to fuck your wife.
Not the route I choose, but okay.
Yeah,
not
the route I choose. Like, you know, there's some levels. There's some steps you take to maybe get back at a family member that pisses you off. You know, he's trying to jump to step 22 instead of starting at step one.
I mean, I think he's a guy that always leaps up to that extreme, because his first thought about this abandoned building is, let me just like fuck everybody in sight.
Yeah, I want to fuck everyone in sight. I want this to be the biggest party ever, which, you know, to his credit, it is a great party at first.
Then everybody dies.
Yes. You know, it was at this point, like, because, you know, I may have been going into this expecting it to be as scary as like Haunting at Hill House. And like, you know, I will say, at least after watching the first four episodes, it definitely isn't. But like when something like scary does happen, like that's the word I'm looking for here. I was impressed, or I enjoyed it. You know what I mean?
I was going to say I was ill prepared, because it feels like the scares in this one, it kind of reminds me of The Bly Manor. I think that's what they called the second show to Hill House. Where it wasn't as scary, it was more geared towards the storytelling, but there was still that like shock factor of just pure horror events. It's not very jump scary like Hill House was.
Yeah. And to where, like, you know, there's not a lot of jump scares in this, but when they do have them, they're well done.
I would say we skipped over the whole mother storyline from the first episode, but I only bring that up because there is that great subtle moment of her shadow being in the background behind Dupin during one of their conversational scenes. And that's like that level of like subtle uneasiness that Flanagan's like really good at injecting into his stories to make you stay on edge the entire time.
Oh yeah. I didn't notice that at first. Like I had to rewind it and then caught it. And so then each of these episodes, when he's telling like the next story of one of his kids, now I'm constantly looking for it, but then I get caught up in the dialogue and then I'm not, you know, looking for it anymore. And then boom, it happens. And I'm just like, God damn it. Shit.
So I feel like Flanagan might've got some slack, probably not from a lot of us, but maybe some people weren't happy with how much stuff he liked to hide in the background. I think it's interesting because it makes me have to pay attention to more things. But it's funny because after the first episode or first reveal that Mike John was talking about with the mother, there's almost a visceral reaction from the father every time he sees something, so that we know there's something there so we can look for it.
Yeah, no, I love that. Yeah, because it would be Roderick is talking, or, you know, telling whatever the story is, and then he just kind of stops and he stares. And every time, like, I didn't catch what it was at first, which I think that was, Flanagan probably definitely did on purpose. Like, you wouldn't be able to see it right away, and then it would cut back to him. He would either move or turn in some kind of direction, then boom, you know, there's somebody right there in front of him.
do we want to discuss how we felt about the second episode now, or do you want to just move on to the third one? Because we didn't talk about the death scene.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, I was just going to jump in, like, all right, before we move on to the next, like, you know, what'd you guys think of the death?
Well, as far as Perry goes, I think that was the sticky ending he wasn't hoping for.
Yeah, definitely. You know, nothing ruins your orgy more than, instead of water coming down from the sprinkler system, is a corrosive acidic material, especially when everyone's pretty much naked.
I don't know what they made, what material that was, but they melted so fast.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I've never seen people turn into soup that quick.
I've never heard so much squelching in one scene.
The audio was so wet.
It was so wet.
It was definitely the goriest I've seen come out of Flanagan as far as his shows go. I mean, I haven't seen Midnight Mass, but I was kind of taken aback by how like brutal the death was, especially for the first, what was essentially the first major kill of the franchise, of the series.
Yeah. And what I think is even, what's even better about it is that, like, the lights are mostly off during it, so you really don't see a lot of it. Like, you can tell what's happening. You can tell, like, people are screaming. You can see, like, people are slowly getting deformed. But you really, it's, you can't see it all that well, but you can hear everything. So, like, in my mind, that immediately had me imagining, like, you know, people are, like, freaking out for this, and they're probably trying to, like, wipe it off, and all they're doing is wiping off skin.
To the point where they're just a huddled mass of, like, organs and skin and bone.
Oh, yeah. Like, once this is over, like, it is literally just a pile of meat on the floor.
I wanted to talk about Carla Cugino because she deserves to be spoken about in every episode going on. She is the titular Mask of Red Death in this episode, and she comes in. And I thought it was interesting because this portrayal is probably the most Carla Cugino of anything else she does in this series, which is a great baseline because she just has such versatility so far in this run.
Yeah, and I would expect this is probably going to be Jarvis's favorite scene of the series.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Oh, mine too, bro.
For those that, you know, haven't watched it, they're just listening to this. She's basically wearing just a red cape mask and a black lingerie number this whole scene she's in.
Oh, mama. I will say, though, just a little callback to what we were talking about earlier when we were describing how we feel this character. I think one of the reasons, maybe Chris can sympathize with me, of why I see her more of like an angel of death than a demon is because she tries to tell the innocent that aren't involved to get out of the way so that they don't become part of the calamity that's about to ensue.
Yeah, because they do mention that like the whole wait staff like left. Like they were gone. And then
like someone told them to leave.
Yeah. And, you know, we see Frederick's wife is there in the corner and she kind of goes by her and like whispers like, you know, go now. Unfortunately, she does not go, but she actually ends up being like the sole survivor of this whole massive goo. And we'll see, at least after, as of like the fourth episode, we don't know what else happens with that, but we'll probably bring that up the next episode.
If you can call that survival, what she's going through.
Yeah, definitely not survival.
Vegetable soup.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Because like a tomato bisque.
Like a tomato soup.
Yeah.
Pizza
She's
crust.
The main ingredient in vegetable soup right now.
She's what I think of when I think of a Wawa pizza. I have a question though. Because what going through these series, the thing that triggered me in mind with this, especially this episode, was do we think that Flanagan is doing that trope of every character represents a deadly sin? Because if so, you know, this episode is blatantly lust. I've been trying to figure out if that's where he's going because there are six siblings. There's one dad. I know like when the Hill House came out, everyone said that all those characters were metaphors for the stages of grief. I was just curious if you guys saw it going that way or if you have like different opinions on that.
You know, I was so caught up in it, I didn't even think of that. But no, I can see where that's going. Because, yeah, like, Perry is clearly, like, lust. I guess you could say Leo which we'll get, we'll mention him like once we get to episode 4 of the Black Cat, but I would feel like he's definitely like Wrath. I don't know who I would classify Camille. Because she's the character that we're about to talk about in episode 3. I don't know what she would be classified as.
I'd say her character is probably Pride. Especially with the way she carries herself in the third episode. I'm thinking she's probably Pride.
Yeah. Well, a perfect segue. Let's talk about episode 3. Who's got like a favorite part of episode 3? Murder in the Rue Morgue.
Murder in the Rue Morgue.
So I gotta say, I think my favorite part of episode 3, God, I forget her name already, our Angel of Death. I think it's her performance as this.
Oh, Verna?
Yeah, I think her performance of being like the security guard that morphs into the chimp right in front of Camille's eyes. And then Camille just kind of knows it's going to happen. And she's just like, fuck it. I'm dead anyway. Which I thought was probably the most gangster way to go out.
Oh, yeah.
but, like, I loved how she's just the security guard. And then, like, you see, like, her mannerisms form. And I don't know if you guys noticed this, but to me, it looked like when they did that one shot over Verna's back, it looked like one of her shoulders had fur, as if they were hinting, like, she's the chimp.
Yeah, so that's what I was thinking when she first, like, shows up in that scene when Camille's trying to, like, get dirt on her other sister. Not that I'm just kind of looking over my other monitor to see Victorine.
Yeah, it starts with a V.
She's just trying to get dirt on her, and you know, you hear like one of the cages like slam open, but then it cuts to Verna there, and I was like, oh, okay, she's clearly like there as one of these monkeys.
She did that little gesture where she had her her arm and her fist like up against her chest, and it's like such a chimpanzee like posture and mannerism. Again, this is what I'm talking about, how Carla steals the show every time she's on screen, because this is a vastly different portrayal of a character to what she did the last episode.
I wholeheartedly agree. I also like that her performance was so captivating. That the entire time in the back of your head, you're thinking, where's the chimp? But then you're just paying attention to her and you keep forgetting about it. Because that's what was happening to me. I'm like, where's 100%. The chimp at? And then she's talking and I'm like, crap, where's the chimp?
And then, you know, Camille then does find the chimp because she gets horror shit rocked.
Again, another excellent, excellent death for this series.
Oh, and then when the doctors find the chimp in the morning and it smiles, chills. I was like, no, because there's no way any human's ever going to survive a fight with a chimp. And if the chimp smiles, it enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the 2020s is the era of chimp related murders in horror films. Nope.
I got nothing.
You're going to have to fill that in for us. Yeah.
I got nothing.
Yeah, I was thinking Nope. So Nope in this. So just the two.
Oh, I didn't see Nope yet. So
I'll offer my resignation now. Bye.
Yeah, it's on the list. But yeah, I don't know if there's really much else I would want to talk about this episode, because yeah, like I think the only thing I would like to say, like, is, you know, the episode opens with them like trying to, like, you know, it seems like only one person of the family is upset about Perry being dead, and everyone is just kind of like, oh, man. So how do we make spin this so that we look good?
That's the shocking thing is, again, it adds to how hateful I am of these characters. They're so unmoved by their own blood being killed off because they're just so invested in themselves. Like, no one seems like they care about anybody else, even Roderick. Like, once one of his own kids is dead, he's like, okay, how do we take care of this? How do we spin this in our favor?
And by this point, like, I wasn't sure who was going to be, like, the dead kid in this episode. But as soon as, you know, Camille started talking about how to spin it in a PR sense to make them look better, since they're supposed to be on this, the whole family's supposed to be on this huge trial right now, I was like, oh, she's definitely the one dying in this episode, 100%.
I wanted to say, you know, in just like, you know, all of the writing for the show, I remember when I saw the title, I was thinking Murder in the Rue Morgue. How are they going to spin? How are they going to make a story about that? That it's not really a horror story. And I never even thought about the chimpanzees in this episode. You know, I know because you early on, you know that they're testing these animals and there's like this room full of them. But I kept on thinking about like a morgue and I never even thought that they were going to set it up like that to the point when she's in the room and the gate swung open. My jaw dropped. I was like, this is fucking amazing.
They do give you a big hint early in the episode when they're talking about the building and how when it was first established, they called it like the Rue Zoo when they were having that conversation, because they're like, they're showing you the sign. It's called Rue. And then you're like, oh, what is that going to entail? And then it's just right over your head if you're not fully paying attention to the name of the episode and stuff.
Yeah, I completely missed that.
It's so captivating. They just all do such a great job.
All right, well, let's get ready to start wrapping this up and talk about the last episode, which I think so far of the first half was my favorite, and that was The Black Cat.
This is the one that definitely gave me like Stephen King vibes. Like the whole story about this guy being driven mad by this cat that he's trying to cover up his mistakes for it's almost a perfect horror story if you eliminated everything else from it. Like the overarching narrative, it was just about this dude going nuts. It's so fascinating to watch.
Yeah. And you know, when I saw a title like The Black Cat, like, and Dan said this best when I talked to him before we started recording this now, he saw it and was like, oh, The Black Cat. Oh man, I hope I see the main character spiral and completely lose everything and all of his sanity and then just fall off a balcony. Oh, hey, look, that character lost complete grasp of sanity and fell off a balcony. All right, cool. I'm happy with this.
I think I got to say that probably I do enjoy that episode, but I think my favorite thing about the episode was when the cat just kind of starts disappearing and the lady's there, Verna's there, and I don't remember his name, Leo, makes the comment of just like, wow, maybe I do need to stop doing drugs. Like, that was probably my favorite part of the whole episode was that, and then him quoting, I can just get another hammer from Hemsworth as he's beating the walls in with Thor's hammer.
He had his own like copy of Mjolnir and was breaking the walls. I'd say like all the kids, like at least most of them you see, like they all have some kind of like drug or alcohol addiction, but Leo's the one that has a lot of drug problems. The fact that like Frederick shows up asking him for just like some kind of drug to get over like his wife being in so much pain in the hospital with her skin becoming soup, and he just pulls out that little box like, you want this, you want this.
So I feel like the one that has probably the weirdest addiction, and again, I'm not knocking anybody's fetishes, but the wife who's a cuck, I don't remember her name, but like
that's Tamerlan or Tamerlane, okay. I think her name is.
I was so confused. I was like, what is happening? Does she just want to see him act like does she want to look at it from an outside perspective? I don't know what's going on. And then like it later you see her start and you're like, oh, she likes to watch. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and I imagine we'll probably learn more about that I think it was maybe episode 5. I think I may have saw the title might be more related to her, but yeah, her story's coming.
Episode 5 is actually, what's her name? Starts with a V.
Victorine.
Yeah, that's her episode, because it's called The Telltale Heart, which I'm so excited for.
Oh, yeah, same. Oh, yeah. It's episode 6 is Tamerlan's. That's hers. I think they just call her Tammy. Goldbug, yeah. But my last little bit about the Black Cat, you know, when he's finally like losing his shit and his boyfriend comes back home and he's just like, his boyfriend shows up and like all the holes all in the wall. And I'm just like, I'm just waiting for him to finally like find the actual cat. And then, yeah, sure enough, there's the cat and we see, you know, Verna's body, or at least, you know, what she's making him see as her body. And yep, that's when he just like took the tumble. And that just wanted me to point out, like, again, like there's not as much scares going on. But when there is something with like special effects wise, so far, at least from what I've seen, has all looked very good. Like the special effects of her in the wall with her eyeball hanging out, I thought was fantastic.
I agree that it's this show is really like slow moving at certain points, and then when it picks up, the tension just picks up pace with like the progression of the show, and it just really gets you like on the edge of your seat.
The show overall, the cast is fantastic. Each episode is very driven in where you're captivated on what's going on in the story, which sibling's going to die, what's going to happen, how's it going to happen. And it draws you in and it holds you there until the actual climax of the episode where you see it happen and then you see everybody else react to it. And it's just like, it gives you a satisfaction because you hate these characters. And I love the way that that's done. Also, we haven't talked about one of the best characters in it, voiced by Mr. Mark Hamill. Love him.
Oh, Attorney Pym.
Yeah, Mark fucking Hamill.
Love him so much. Yeah.
Playing this like fixer.
Yeah, he's basically like the fixer, like the family attorney, basically the one that gets them out of all of their legal trouble. And yeah, he's great in almost every scene he's in the series, especially like in the beginning of the series when they have the family on trial and Dupin is trying to like have this case for the defense, and Mark Hamill just sits there while doing a crossword puzzle going, objection.
When I first saw him, I didn't even know it was him. The way he was talking and the way his facial hair had been growing out, I thought he was the police chief from Super Troopers. I was really thrown off by it. And then when I realized it was Mark, it's such a great performance because it's so different from, you know, Luke Skywalker and so different from the Joker. It's this very reserved performance and very calculated performance, which is not something I've seen him do.
He has talked about in like interviews over the last few years how he wants to get away from doing a lot of voice acting and doing more serious roles because he enjoys it. It challenges him as an actor. And I think he did a great job in this. Like behind Verna, he's my favorite character. Because whenever he does show up on screen, even though it's very short, I fully believe his character.
No, I agree. And yeah, like you say, he's basically the fixer. Like anything that's happened with all these kids, like he's the first one they have like basically investigating and research into it. And he's also the one like making sure, you know, the press and the media kind of stay away from it as long as possible.
Did either of you want him when he shows up to the scene at the warehouse when the guy's like, you can't come in? Did any of you kind of want him to just wave his hand when he picks up the phone call and be like, you'll let me in? And then just walk by him. I was hoping for it so bad. I just wanted to see the little Jedi mind trick. And he just walks by. And when somebody's like, what is that? He's like, I'm a lawyer. Don't ask questions.
Yeah, don't ask questions. So before we, you know, wrap and close out, the last thing I want to mention that happens in each of these episodes, besides Verna being there and pretty much being the reason that all these members of the family die, she gives a moment to each of them to basically like change their mind and change their course so that they don't die. And of course they're all just assholes and stuck in their ways. And so they fight her on it. And then, yeah, that's when they die. And I thought that's I really like that in each one. Like I like that even though she's tormenting them, she does give them like one last chance at the end of like, you know, yeah, this doesn't have to happen.
She also like passes like a little judgment on them. She seems like she's trying to show them the error of their sin. Because everybody, like, she talks to Flanagan's wife and talking about, like, you know, the torture that's being done to these animals and how it's practically a useless gesture. So she's almost like trying to appeal to them about why they're wrong for what they're doing.
Yeah, and they could fucking care less.
I think a great example of her trying to steer somebody away is when she's talking to Leo and he's in the, he's at the shelter and she's like, why don't you get this cat or this cat? Like you could save an animal's life because we're not a non-kill shelter. And he's like, no, I need a black cat. And she's like, what about these two? And she's just like, just take a different cat home. it'll be fine. And she, I feel like she gave him the most chances. And then he's like, nope, I'm taking that one. How much is it? She's like, well, some people have already asked for that. And he's like, I don't care. I'm leaving with that cat. And she's like, you can kind of see her look at him like, all right, well, you're going to die.
Yeah. And it's basically like he pulls the kind of thing of like, do you know who I am? Like, money's not an option. Like, I will spend whatever money. And yeah, she's essentially telling him like, you can get, you know, this cat or these cats. And basically like, fess up to your boyfriend that in your drugged up stupor, you killed his cat. Like, own up to your shit.
Or even if you don't want to confess that you murdered the cat, you could bring home another cat and be like, hey, you know, I think the cat might be dead. They've been gone longer than they normally are. And I feel like this cat was going to die at the no kill shelter. So I thought we could bring it home and take care of it, at least until Pluto shows up.
Yeah. Like, he could have still tried to do something better than, you know, just covering his ass.
I know the whole point of that cat is that it's supposed to be a representation of, you know, his anger and all the his faults, and it's his own punishment. But fuck that cat, man. That cat was a piece of shit that entire episode.
I've never wanted to punch a cat more in my life. Like, he looks up and the cat looks at him, gives him that face like, oh, hey. And it's like for like a split second, you're like, oh, pretty kitty. And then he rips his eye. And I was like, oh, skin it. I can't.
You know, there's a, because that's when the brother comes to get the drugs and he gets scratched in the eye. He runs into the bathroom to clean it out. And the brother's just together. He's like, well, I'm going to take the drugs. And I'm gonna go.
Just like, I'm just gonna take the coke then. Say ya.
The fucking part where he just goes, "Is it your eye?" And he's just going in the bathroom. Fuck! I think it's your eye. I'm gonna take these drugs. Shit!
Well, I mean, he did get the cat back for his eye.
Oh yeah, I was so confused as to whether that was actually Pluto or if it was the cat, but then I saw the collar and I was like, wait a minute, did he imagine that he killed the cat?
I think he did. Yeah.
That's nuts.
I think that was, yeah. I think like in that moment, like towards the end of it where like you see him like squeeze the cat's head. Like, I think that was just him visioning like probably what he did to Pluto in his like, you know, drugged up stupor. You guys got anything else you want to mention before I go to close it out?
I'm just looking forward to the rest of this. I this has probably been one of the best like Halloween period things I've watched this year, and it's just got me completely captivated. I think this is like peak horror television for sure.
I agree with it. It definitely came out at a perfect time. You know, it's spooky season, and again, it's not as scary as Hill House, and I think Hill House will always be my favorite because I'm a big fan of that shock jump scare. But I just love the way these characters are portrayed. The show is phenomenal so far. I just hope that it stays that way, and then we don't have like a ending that feels like it's cut short, which I don't think it's going to. But sometimes when things are too hyped up through the show, it kind of, the ending's almost lackluster. I don't think it's going to be, considering the last episode's called The Raven, but I will see.
Yeah. I mean, if it gives you any kind of, you know, comfort, it does look like rating wise with the episodes, they pretty much went up as it went on.
I was going to say, I think all of them got over a 7, right?
Yeah. I think the lowest, maybe the lowest rated one was the first episode.
Yeah, 7.7 on the first episode, which is nuts. For an episode that's just set up, the lowest rating is a 7.7?
Yeah, and everything else is 8 or higher. So, yeah, I think we don't have to worry about anything getting bad, but I am looking forward to watching these last four episodes and looking forward to talking to you guys and possibly a special guest person next week. So, it should be fun.
Sweet. I'm always down.
All right, so we're gonna go ahead and wrap this up. I'd like to thank Connor McLeod for our artwork and Andy Cavanaugh for our music. You can find all of our social media links in the description, And looking forward to wrapping up the series and sitting and waiting for another Mike Flanagan project. That'll probably be, you know, several years away. Mike, what do you say to all those ravens out there quoting Nevermore?
Thanks for stopping by for a hot cup of spoop.